Today at Reader's Corner, Eric Larson, author of In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin.
I really set out to answer one very specific thing, and that was, you know, what would it have been like to have been alive in that first year of Hitler's rule? William E. Dodd, he went to Berlin with the idea that he was going to be objective. He was not going to prejudge the Third Reich. That's why I particularly like these characters, Dodd and his daughters, because they both change their views in the course of that first year of Hitler's rule. And as a nonfiction writer, you're always looking for that.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. When President Franklin Roosevelt selected mild-mannered University of Chicago history professor William Dodd to serve as America's ambassador to Nazi Germany in 1933, neither man had an inkling of the coming terror. In fact, Dodd accepted the post in part because he believed his light duties would allow him time to complete his exhaustive history of the American South. The reality of Hitler's Germany, as experienced by Dodd and his family during his 4 years as ambassador, is detailed in a book by today's guest, Eric Larson, titled In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. The New York Times bestseller offers a firsthand account of the excitement, intrigue, and horror of the Nazi era, and explains in part how the world failed to recognize the impending danger of the Nazi regime. The book is now out in paperback. We are featuring an encore edition of our interview with Eric Larson. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including The Devil in White City, which won an Edgar Award for nonfiction crime writing and was a finalist for the National Book Award. He joined us by phone from his home in Seattle for this interview. Eric Larson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, the events that you write about occurred over 80 years ago in the 1930s in Berlin, Germany. Is this just a history lesson about another time, or is there something to be learned in today's world?
Well, I think there's always something to be learned, but I have to say that I did not set out with the intention of, you know, flogging any particular, I did not have any kind of goal to point out any issues today for which this past Nazi era could serve as some sort of a model. I really set out to answer one very specific thing, and that was, you know, what would it have been like to have been alive in that first year of Hitler's rule, and to find the right characters to tell that story.
Is it difficult when you're writing a narrative and you get into it and find out what it was like, and yet you're living in 2010 or whenever this book was written, 11, and you're thinking, man, I can't believe this guy is as clueless as he is, and his daughter even more so than him. Is it tempting to get so emotionally involved that all of a sudden your views start leaking through the pages?
Well, it's very important to maintain what every screenwriter knows and every writer should know is, you know, point of view. I had to really discipline myself to, you know, obviously I can't forget that I know what happened. I know how all this turned out, you know, World War II and the Holocaust and so forth. But in writing about this, I really did discipline myself to try to look at the world through the eyes of the Dodds and through the players around them, people who did not know where this was all going to end up. And because, you know, I think it'd be very tempting for a writer to maybe impose his judgments on the past, but you really can't do that because, frankly, it's not fair to the characters. You know, they didn't know all this stuff coming down the pike.
Well, yeah, it's like trying to use a 2013 lens to take a photo of the 1930s Germany.
Yeah. I mean, for example, once I gave a talk and one guy in the audience was kind of on my case for not being more judgmental in my book with regard to Roosevelt and Dodd. You know, yeah. Why wasn't I harder on them for Roosevelt's failure to call out Hitler, and why wasn't I harder on Dodd for his sort of low-grade anti-Semitism? And, you know, the answer is it's not my place. You know, they were creatures of their time, and it's not up to me to go jumping up and down saying, look, these guys were horrible. It's my my job to put us all in their heads, in their time, and maybe even raise the question for readers, well, what would I have done? What would you have done?
So Universal is said to have a movie in the works starring Tom Hanks and Natalie Portman. Is that still on track?
It's still on track. We're still doing the dotting of T's and I's, believe it or not, on the final contract. But there is an option. They've acquired the option. Tom Hanks is apparently talking about various actors to play various characters, and is apparently interested in a particular director. But beyond that, I'm really not at liberty to talk much about it until you have that final thing hammered down. But yeah, so far so good.
Right. Well, you had the same thing happen with The Devil in the White City. That became a movie, correct?
It has not become a movie, but in that case, the option has been acquired. The contract has been signed. A screenplay has been turned in. I don't know what the status is of that screenplay. Obviously, it's very important in that case. In that case, the prime mover behind the deal was Leonardo DiCaprio.
That's what I read, and I just assumed that it's a movie that I must have missed.
Well, if it was that small a movie, I'd be feeling kind of bad right now. But no, it's that is very much on track. I really don't know exactly what the status is right now of the screenplay and where things are in terms of how close or not close to actually putting film in the camera. These things are. See, I should explain my attitude. My attitude about film is that, you know, I'm not a filmmaker. I'm not a screenwriter. I am a writer. And for me to really get involved in these film projects would be a real distraction from what I do and from what I love. And so I take the Tom Wolfe approach. This is a bad paraphrase of what he once said, but you know, he once said that you when you're dealing with Hollywood, you take your book to the fence. Pass it over, take the bag of money, and run.
Well, I think you probably answered my next question, because I've read so many accounts of writers who hand their book over the fence and then complain for the rest of their lives that the screenplay was an abomination compared to this beautiful work that I wrote. And I was going to ask you, you know, how does that work out for you? Do you, first of all, I assume, I'm asking theoretically now, I don't want to intrude on your individual relationships with these contracts and whatever, but you do relinquish the right to the specifics of the screenplay once you sign a contract? Is that the way it works?
Yeah, I mean, unless they ask you, unless you are specifically envisioned as being the writer of a screenplay, and that would be really quite rare, frankly. The way it works is you give the book to them and you hope for the best. Now they'll try to maybe keep you in the loop and bounce ideas off you, and they may try to use you as a consultant and so forth. But you see, my attitude is that when I finish a book, that book is done. You know, that book is launched. It's like when you're sure. When your kid goes off to finish his college, you know, and is out there in the real world. You know, you can hope for the best, obviously, pray for the best, but in the end, it's up to that kid, right?
Right, right.
And that's how I feel about these books. You know, these books are in the hands of people who, presumably, especially in this case, I mean, you know, these are classy guys, Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio. I mean, I this is not an experiment in, oh, can this guy make a movie? We know that
that's right.
So what am I going to add to the party? You know, I mean, I don't want to diminish my own role, I guess, but I'm just a writer.
Well, you could add a cameo role.
I don't know how those things come about, actually. And I don't know that I'd want a cameo role. Who knows what I'd be? You know,
even the cameo role would probably be like 100 takes. It all looks good when you get it in the movie theater, but putting it together it's a lot more work than it looks.
Well, that's it. I mean, the few times that I've actually had to do something involving being on film, whether it's for like a news show or, you know, once there was a documentary done about my, believe it or not, about my very first book called The Naked Consumer. And I'll tell you, after those few experiences, I have total admiration for actors because, you know, there's a lot of tedious stuff. It's for the same reason I actually avoid, I don't read my own books aloud for the audiobooks. Because, you know, having done briefly some audio stuff, that is incredibly tedious. You know, you break up sentences and redo a portion of the sentence. It's hard work.
Let's talk about William Dodd, the guy picked by Roosevelt to become the ambassador to Germany. How did an academic get this job? What were his qualifications? And I guess he wasn't the first guy to be asked to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I could take the next 45 minutes talking about how this all came about, but essentially, you know, a lot of other people were asked. Nobody wanted the job for a variety of reasons. Although I think the central reason was that, you know, who wants to go work as an ambassador to a country run by a madman? You know, and even at this point, nobody knew what was ultimately going to come. I think everybody sort of assumed that this guy Hitler would burn out in the course of a year or so, and then things would get back to normal. So nobody wanted to put up with that kind of thing. You know, it was not exactly envisioned to be a career maker. So, you know, Roosevelt went out and asked a number of people. They all turned him down. And then during a meeting, a friend of Dodd's said, well, what about William E. Dodd? And, you know, the idea appealed to Roosevelt because what he wanted most of all, I think he recognized that there was very little that an ambassador could actually do in that context. And I think what he really wanted was somebody to just, what he said he wanted was he wanted someone in that post in Berlin to serve as a standing model of American liberal values. So in picking Dodd, he really was pretty much on the money for that, because Dodd was a true Jeffersonian Democrat from the get-go. He was honest. He had a lot of integrity. And as it turned out, he was not a guy who was going to fall for the flash and dash of the Nazi Party. So on some level, it made sense, but certainly it was the fallback choice. And a lot of people were startled when Dodd, very much an outsider to the State Department, was named for the job. Having said that, the true miracle of the book is that Dodd, once tapped by Roosevelt, was confirmed in 48 hours.
Yeah, and of course, the 30s was such a period of staunch American isolationism.
Yeah,
why were Americans in that era so much against getting involved in European affairs?
There's a lot of things that played into that, but one of the most important is that everybody was still sort of reeling from World War I and the aftermath of that. And I think that was probably the most salient aspect. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you touched on something very important also, though, is that America was always very much isolationist. I mean, even when World War I was starting to, you know, look like, when it was starting in the early 20th century to look as though the first world war, this big war, was gonna start happening, even then, you know, without a prior major war, we still didn't want to have any part in European affairs. We still wanted to be very, very much a neutral nation.
Now, when Dodd gets over there in, let's say, his first or his second year, he still doesn't know what is really going on inside Germany, and first of all, some of it hasn't happened yet, I suppose,
right,
when it comes to what Hitler does with the camps and the Jews.
Yeah, no, when Dodd gets over there, I mean, the first thing that happens is William E. Dodd, he went to Berlin with the idea that he was going to be objective. You know, he was not going to prejudge the Third Reich. And so, you know, he arrives in Berlin and kind of looks around and you know, he's inclined at first to give them all the benefit of the doubt. But in the course of that first year in Berlin, he begins to see very clearly that something is very, very deeply wrong. And in fact, that's why I particularly like these characters, the Dodds, Dodd and his daughters, because they both change their views in the course of that first year of Hitler's rule. And as a nonfiction writer, you're always looking for that. I mean, you know, in novels, in fiction, characters are always changing. You know, there's conflict and change, and of course that makes it very satisfying. But in real life, you know, people often don't change, right? And so here you have a couple of real-life characters, though, who were deeply changed by the sort of darkening experience of that first year. That became very, very much a powerful thing for me.
Now, when Dodd took over this job, he was opposed by some very influential people in the State Department. I think they called themselves the Pretty Good Club. I'm not so sure I understand what that means, but you can tell us. But I guess my question is, would these wealthy elites who were in the State Department coming out of the right schools and the right families, any way of knowing whether if they were thrown into Dodd's position, they would have figured this out as quickly as he did?
Well, I'll tell you, I think actually there's an interesting way to answer that question. The guy who followed Dodd after he was essentially forced out of Berlin, the guy who followed him was a guy named Hugh Wilson, who really, for all intents and purposes, was a Nazi sympathizer. I mean, he found a lot to like about the Third Reich and its measures with regard to labor and so forth, until, that is, in his defense, until 1938 and Kristallnacht, when even he realized that this was a sick culture. But I think right there you have... You had a case where, you know, you had Dodd, who I personally think should if you were going to assign him a letter grade, I'd give him a B+, because I don't think anybody else could have done a better job in there, and a lot of people could have done a lot worse job. And what Dodd did was he stood his ground. He didn't fall for, as I said, he didn't fall for that flash and dash. He really stood up for American liberal values and in the end was hated by the Nazi regime. And my feeling is if you are hated by the Nazi regime, you must have done something right. Mm-hmm. And so here he is, followed by this guy, Hugh Wilson, who is a State Department insider, the classic kind of guy who would ordinarily be thought to be appointed as a diplomat. And he's pro-Nazi. Mm-hmm. You know, he's very much in favor of the regime. So things could have been a lot worse. That's my feeling.
You're listening to Eric Larson. He's the author of In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. Tell us about the title, In the Garden of Beasts.
Yeah, well, you know, the title came to me after I visited Berlin. My main goal in going to Berlin was to try to visit all the addresses. You know, I figured there wouldn't be much there because, you know, this central area of Berlin where everybody lived and where the Gestapo was headquartered and so forth was essentially leveled in the Russian assault on Berlin at the end of World War II. So I just essentially went to find these addresses and kind of walk the ground. You know, you never know what you're going to find when you do that. And one thing I discovered, much to my surprise, is how close everything was to everything else. Like the Dodd's house, Martha could walk to the Gestapo headquarters, you know, where she was dating the first chief of the Gestapo. She could walk there in 15 minutes. A dog could walk to one of Hitler's offices in 15 minutes. He could walk across the park to the Reichstag, the main government building, in, you know, 15 or 20 minutes. And I was really impressed by this, that all this was happening essentially around the eastern quarter of this central park of Berlin called the Tiergarten, which means literally Garden of Beasts. So that's why and how the title came to be.
Now, when Dodd arrived in Germany, one of his first opponents was the American Consul General George Messerschmitt. Did he play a role in changing Dodd's approach to this?
You know, there's a nuanced relationship, let me tell you. I mean, you know, initially, I think Dodd, I think throughout Dodd's career, George Messerschmitt, not to be confused with Willy Messerschmitt, who built the the famous German aircraft, but George Messerschmitt, American through and through, clearly wanted Dodd's job, or if not Dodd's job, at least something better than consul general. And of course, eventually he got his wish, but. But there was a lot of tension there between the two throughout that time, and I think Messerschmitt tried to cast himself as the guy who knew all, and frankly did know all. He knew much more about what was happening than Dodd did. Dodd came in, frankly, naive. Dodd learned very quickly, but Messerschmitt was far more knowledgeable throughout that time and was able to leverage that to some extent to build discontent with Dodd within the State Department, mm-hmm. although there was plenty of discontent to begin with.
So after 4 years of service, Dodd lost Roosevelt's confidence and was forced to resign. What's behind this? Is this Roosevelt not getting it?
You know, I can only write what I can find in the sources and so forth, but if I could just speculate for a bit, I mean, my feeling is that Roosevelt was actually reasonably happy with Dodd, but that he was getting so much pressure from the Nazi regime to the point where they were essentially going to, isolate Dodd and to some extent already had isolated Dodd. And Dodd didn't even want to talk to the regime that he was sent to liaise with. So this was a real sort of a fundamental problem. And I think what happened is that Roosevelt finally realized, look, you know, you got to have an ambassador who's going to be at least talking to the Nazis, although I think he was very pleased with the fact that the Nazis were really ticked off at Dodd.
You know, my wife read this book when it first came out. I didn't read it until just recently. And when she read it, I can remember so distinctly, we'd be sitting somewhere and all of a sudden I'd hear, I don't believe this woman. She's clueless. Unbelievable. Well, you know, I mean, I was getting all these takes on Martha Dodd. tell us a little bit about his daughter, who, of course, comes over as an adult along with her brother. And you don't talk much about her brother. I found that interesting, what he did while he was over there. But Martha Dodd is clearly the more interesting of the two when it comes to this story.
Well, one reason I don't talk about the brother, let me just address that first, though, is that for one thing, he really was, I hate to say this about anybody, but he really was kind of a non-entity. And he didn't leave a terribly rich record of correspondence or anything else. But more than that, I'm the father of three daughters, and I really like the idea of this father-daughter thing, you know, in terms of these two real-life characters arriving in Berlin. What I really loved was the fact that they both brought a certain level of naivete. You know, Dodd wanted to be objective, but Martha, you know, when she arrived, she fell for the whole thing. She fell in love with the Nazi revolution. She found it, you know, intoxicating at first. And when I first realized that, I thought, wow, that's why I knew that these had to be my characters. Because, you know, how interesting to have the daughter of the American ambassador coming to Nazi Germany, and she's in love with the whole thing.
Including getting set up with Hitler.
Well, including getting set up with Hitler. How serious that intent was, I don't know, but the guy who set it up, Putzi Amstengel, one of Hitler's, at that point, right-hand guys, he certainly seemed intent on the possibility of Hitler and Martha, you know, becoming a couple. And so there was that very sort of, I think, very funny, but very sort of also scary scene where they encounter each other for the first and last time at lunch in an arranged kind of blind date encounter by Putzi. But I found Martha to be, you know, there's a whole range of opinions, let me tell you, that I've learned now about Martha, ranging from an awful lot of younger women who see her as kind of the forerunner of the liberated woman, and then to guys of a certain age who will sort of chortle and say, "Oh, she's quite the slut, wasn't she?"
Well, one of her romantic encounters was with Rudolf Diels. I mean, this guy was the first chief of the Gestapo, so I don't know whether I can get too excited about calling her liberated as a woman with that kind of a call.
But here's the thing. Another thing that I was really surprised by, first of all, I never even knew that there was a first chief of the Gestapo. You know, I mean, I always assumed it was Himmler and Heydrich throughout, and they were bad to the core. But one of the things I found early on was that Rudolf Diels, the guy who was the first chief when the Gestapo was founded in April of 1933, Rudolf Diels was a very complicated character. He was very well liked by the diplomatic corps. Dodd respected him, thought he had a lot of integrity. He was really considered to be really pretty much a good guy. He was a very useful guy when ambassadors would try to extricate their nationals from prison if they happened to end up there. So he was a complicated character, you know, I think that I can see how somebody like Martha would fall for the guy. In fact, I showed his picture around every chance I got when I was working on the book. And I would ask the women, and you know, who came to the house for dinner, or you know, my daughters and everybody else and their friends. I said, "So, you know, just curious, do you find this guy handsome?" And they would all be like, "You know, he's got something." And, you know, this is a guy that's horribly scarred from like the cheeks on down, but from the cheeks on up, he looks like a young Ray Milland. You know, I mean, he's a good-looking guy. So it's very complicated. And that's what I like. I like nuance.
She also had a relationship with a Soviet diplomat that went on to lead to other aspects of her life. Tell us about what she was doing with this guy and what he convinced her to do.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite aspects also of all this is that you know, she started dating this guy who was one of the you know, they call him secretaries, one of the secretaries at the Soviet embassy, a guy named Boris, handsome guy, very charismatic, and she totally fell for him. I mean, you know, hook, line, and sinker. Now whether she knew, I do not believe that she knew early on that this guy was a spy. I think all that evolved in the course of this I think true romantic relationship. And then I think Boris's handlers realized this relationship could be of use, and Boris, in the end, was, in fact, a communist first, a lover second, and then things began to change. Whether Martha eventually ever became truly an operative for the Soviets, you know, like so many things, she flirted with it. She flirted with the idea of being a spy. I don't think she ever really did much along those lines.
You're listening to Eric Larson. He's the author of In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. Well, the tensions of Dodd's first year really climaxed a couple of weeks later on June 30th, the so-called Night of the Long Knives. What happened and what role does that play in Dodd figuring out what's going on here?
Well, you know, it's a big part of what happens with Dodd. It's a big part of the book as well, because it's the thing that provides the what I like to refer to as narrative tension. One of the things that I was surprised to find is that there was a lot of conflict in that first year within the Third Reich at the upper echelons, especially between Adolf Hitler and his friend and longtime supporter Ernst Röhm. And what happened, a rift grew. This is very much simplifying things, but a rift grew between those two men until Hitler really began to feel threatened. And he launched this really incredibly bloody purge of his opponents, which is now known as the Night of the Long Knives, and began on that June 30th, 1934. And that was just absolutely, you know, wholesale murder and bloodshed of opponents, even some innocent people who were killed simply because, you know, they had names that were like people who were hunted down by Hitler's side. And for Dodd, this was just absolutely repulsive. And he felt after this that he couldn't ever look at Hitler again, he says at one point in one of his writings. And he was convinced the Night of the Long Knives would so enrage the German citizens that they would throw the Nazis out, and he was so dismayed to find that that was not the case.
So Dodd goes back to America after losing FDR's confidence. What happens to Dodd in later years?
Well, what happens to him after he leaves, he feels freer to talk about what he's really feeling about the Third Reich, and he really becomes kind of a Paul Revere in terms of going around the country, doing lectures, and warning of the Nazi threat. And I think I do believe he was one of the first to really see the actual concrete threat that the Nazis posed to Jews. Because very early on, he was warning that it was Hitler's intention to eliminate the Jews. This is long before the Holocaust. I don't want to say long, a matter of years before the Holocaust actually began. So he did that. He was kind of a Paul Revere. There was one really curious, tragic thing that happened, very odd. He was driving along a country road in Virginia one day, and he struck a young black child, and he kept driving. It was sort of a hit and run. He kept driving. He was subsequently arrested. The kid actually recovered. Dodd paid for the kid's medical bills. The kid recovered. Dodd was prosecuted, was convicted, lost his right to vote, which for a hardcore Democrat, you know, who had always studied Jefferson and politics and so forth, was a brutal thing. And it was such an anomalous event. He did get back, by the way. He got his right to vote back through an act of clemency by the state governor. But for somebody like Dodd, the whole thing just made no sense and might have been the result of an illness that was quite soon to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eric, this has been a great opportunity for us to listen to you talk about the book. We've run out of time, but again, the good news for our listeners, it's out in paperback. We can't begin to cover everything, all the nuances of this book that we've talked about today, but we'll get to them in the book. So I want to thank you once again for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. It's been great talking with you.
Well, thank you.
Eric Larson, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Next week, Daniel James Brown, author of The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.